report to you, friends, that my imprisonment here has had the opposite of its intended effect. All the soldiers here and everyone else too found out that I'm in this jail because of the Messiah. That piqued their curiosity, and they've learned all about him. Not only that, but all of the followers of Jesus have become far more sure of themselves in the faith than ever, speaking out fearlessly about God, about this Messiah. It's true that some here preach Christ because, with me out of the way, they think they'll step right into the spotlight. But others do it with the best heart in the world. One group is motivated by pure love, knowing that I'm here defending the message, wanting to help. The others, with me out of the picture, are merely greedy, thinking that they'll step right into the spotlight, get something out of it for themselves. Their motives are bad. They see me as their competition. And so the worse it goes for me, the better they think for them. So how am I to respond? I've decided I don't really care about their motives, whether mixed, bad, or indifferent. No, every time one of them opens their mouth, Christ is proclaimed. So I just cheer them on. Oh, and I'm going to keep going with that celebration because I know how it's going to turn out. Everything Christ wants to do in and through me, it will be done. Through your faithful prayers and the generous response of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, I can hardly wait to continue on my course. And I don't expect to be embarrassed in the least. No, everything happening to me in this jail only serves to make Christ more accurately known, regardless of whether I live or die. They didn't shut me up. They gave me a platform. Alive, I'm Christ's messenger. Dead, I'm his prize. Life versus even more life. I cannot lose. Oh, as long as I'm alive in this body, I know that there's good work for me to do. If I had to choose right now, I hardly know what I would choose. Some days, the desire to break camp and be with Christ is powerful. Some days I can think of nothing better. But most days, because of what you are going through, I know it's better for me to stick it out here. I know that it's better for me to stick it out here.
Well, thank you, Mac. That was Philippians 1, 12 through 26. The way that Paul might have expressed it when he initially wrote this letter from a jail. And the thing that we're going to focus on for the next 4 weeks as we look at this little letter of his is a really important question for you and me. And the question is this: how do you get through what you're going through? Some of you might be in a situation where you're like, oh, I'm going through it right now. Some of you, it's a recent situation, a circumstance. Maybe you're thinking about the next couple of months and what's ahead, and you're going end of year quotas and the pressure at work. Or maybe you're thinking about the holidays and all the craziness that comes with that, and then what it's going to dig up again because he's not here again, or she's not speaking to you again, or because you have a crazy cousin, Eddie. It might be you're thinking about midterms. You're saying, I could never have guessed that sixth grade would be this hard. Whatever it is, we all go through stuff. It's impossible to get out of life without experiencing trouble. And so when a person like me stands up and says, we're going to talk about joy for the next 4 weeks, some of you are like, really? Okay. How about this? How about I'll just string together a couple of days of good traffic on the 405 and call it a day, right? That's enough. Because joy seems impossible from where you sit right now. The text that we're looking at helps us understand this issue. That if you can't get out of it, how do you get through it? Because joy, and tons of sermons have been preached on the difference in joy and happiness. We're going to make that comment a little bit as we go over the next few weeks. But there's a really big difference. Joy is not what happens when everything goes right. Joy is about what is holding you together when everything goes wrong. Joy is not about your circumstance. In fact, you might say it like this, and it's the thing that I want you to get for the next few weeks, that joy is a grace-anchored gladness. It's got roots in something deeper. It's got a foundation that's way more sturdy. Joy is not the emoji smile or the fact that your boss finally noticed you at work. Joy is not that your crush responded to the text. Joy is not even that your favorite team won. Although, I mean, last night, come on. 7th game of the World Series, 11th inning, and my brother from another mother, Will Smith, hits a home run to win back-to-back World Series. I know some of you hate me right now, but you'll find joy today too. It felt a whole lot like joy, I have to say. But that's not it. That's not what we're talking about. It's got to be more than that. And as we look at this book and we try to pull out what does it mean to have, or maybe not to have, what does it mean to build or to learn joy, we find some real surprises. So joy is maybe a more theologically complicated way to say it is this. Joy is the Spirit-produced confidence and gladness. Spirit-produced, not ginned up by you, not circumstance-produced, but the Holy Spirit of God living inside you produces. It is the fruit of a root. Confidence and gladness that comes from knowing that you belong to God and that you're participating in His saving work. It has meaning, it has purpose, it has depth. And it's funny that Paul writes in this book of Philippians all about joy, because as I explained the context of it, this is not the group of people that you would have chosen if you were going to plant, you know, Church of the Joy. This is not your core team. Here's who started the whole church in Philippi. First three converts. One, a woman named Lydia, an older lady. She is successful in business. She is killing it on the outside. And on the inside, she is empty and unfulfilled and unsure if this is all there is. Anybody? She comes into contact with the gospel of good news that Jesus offers abundant life. She pushes all her chips into the center of the table, and she goes in. Second convert, second pillar of the Church of Joy in Philippi, is a demon-possessed slave girl. Probably an ethnic minority, likely either sold or stolen into slavery, probably by a family member. She's been used in some real demonic and dark arts and practices, or she chose them so much so that the demons that were around her have now come inside her. And they give her this really interesting power. All this stuff is in Acts 16, by the way. She walks around able to tell the future. She can tell you what's going to happen next. And Paul and Silas are walking through the city of Philippi one day, and after about 3-4 days of her like following them around saying, they know the way to Jesus, they know the way to the Jesus, Paul gets irritated and he's like, shut up, demon, get out of her. And immediately the demon leaves, but so does her ability to tell the future. Now, I want to make a side comment right here, especially to those of you who are younger, but really any age. If you think that tarot card reading and palm reading and fortune telling is just innocent, it's not. Did you hear what I just said? When the demon left her, her ability to see the future left her as well. It is dark, it is devious, it is Satan himself that's at work in that stuff. Don't play with it. So the demon leaves, and this little slave girl, now she can't make her owners any more money, and they get really ticked off at Paul, so they throw him in jail. And that's where we meet the third pillar of the Philippi community. It's probably a retired old jailer. He had been a soldier. He was at the end of his career. Blue-collar guy, hard worker, grinder. And now he's given the job to guard the prison. And one night, as Paul and Silas sit in there and they pray and sing songs, displaying a real defiant joy in the face of their circumstances, an earthquake comes, knocks down the walls, throws open the gates, and all the prisoners are able to escape. And this guy just made the worst vocational mistake of his career. Anybody? And the only way he can see out of it is to kill himself. It's kind of funny. All the prisoners stay right near the prison, and Paul's like, "Don't worry, we're all here." And the gospel of good news of grace of Jesus completely turns him around to the point that he says, "What can I do to be saved?" So, 1, 2, 3. Businesswoman who's unfulfilled. Ethnic minority who's possessed by demons. Retired guy who just made, you know, you had one job and you failed. Keep the prisoners inside, not outside. He messes up. That's who we start the church of Philippi with. The church is going to be known for joy. And Paul, as you just saw in Mac's little what is the word I was just going to use there? I don't know. His vignette, that's the word. Paul is writing this whole letter about joy from prison. And I'm not talking about like home arrest with an ankle bracelet, binging Netflix all day. He is in a dark, damp dungeon in Rome, chained, 18-inch chain from his arm to a Roman guard all the time. Guess who's the Caesar of Rome? Nero. You ever heard anything about him? Not a good guy. Paul is stuck not knowing if he's going to get in or get out, if he's going to live or if he's going to die. And he writes one of the greatest treatises on how to have joy that we've ever seen. So with that as our context, let me read to you about these three storms Paul mentions that test our joy. And here's why Paul can write this letter. Because joy is not tied to his circumstances. It is anchored in his Savior. And you can have the same thing. Three storms that test our joy. First, Paul says this, verses 12 and 14. You can have joy when circumstances confine you. He says, "Now I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me, being thrown in prison, for setting a demon-possessed girl free, what's happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel. As a result, it's become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I'm in chains for Christ. And because of my chains, most of the brothers and sisters have become confident in the Lord and dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear." Paul says, these chains, they're not a setback. They're actually a setup. They didn't realize it, but when they put me in this prison, and this doesn't make sense, it's incomprehensible, it really is. He's the missionary to all the Gentiles, and he's in prison. You can't do good missionary work in prison unless God is working behind the scenes. Paul says they thought they were going to stop me. It actually caused this to explode, because now people look at me in this situation, and they go, "I want faith like that. I want peace like that. This Jesus must be real." His confinement created a platform for the gospel to go forth. And some of you are in what you might call confining situations right now. Like it may be a job that just feels dead end. There's no way out, but you can't make enough if you go take something else to pay the bills either, and so you're stuck. Some of you watching online are online because you'd love to be here, but physically you can't because of your health and the way things have gone, and you're confined. Some of you are stuck in what feels like a stalemate of a marriage, like a stale mate even. You just think it's never going to get any better than this. Some of us are stuck in a situation where we're on the outside and you think everybody else at school or in the world has a life that's going like this, and yours seems to be going down. Like, we all have moments where we feel stuck and confined, and you feel trapped. But let me tell you, God may use your confinement to further a plan that is bigger than you could imagine and better than you could write on your own, and actually can bring you joy. Now, I know you're thinking, like, that's great for Paul. He saw visions, he met Jesus, he wrote a bunch of stuff that we're reading. He's not normal. This is not a good case study, Jason, to talk to me about joy. And I get that. But I wonder if you could think about where you feel confined or stuck right now And if you could possibly imagine that God could work in your situation rather than just saving you from your situation. Is it possible that God actually has a strategy for where you are, and he's got a purpose that's bigger than what it feels like right now? See, humans can experience, we can endure unimaginable things. When you think about some of the places on earth right now where people experience persecution or difficulty or poverty, or Nazi Germany, Holocaust era times, pick your moment in history. Humans can endure unimaginable things if we believe there's a purpose. And Paul wants us to know that the first place your joy stems from is that God has a strategy. Don't wait to rejoice to find joy until God shows you his strategy. Rejoice that he actually has one, even if you can't see it yet. Remember in 2020? Some of you remember 2020? Okay, it was wild. So glad our middle school and high schoolers are in here with us today. Thank you guys for being here. It's so awesome. So remember when COVID happens, the whole world shuts down? Nobody wants that. Nobody wanted to cancel weddings and funerals and graduations. Nobody wanted it. And you remember those early days on Zoom whenever no one actually knew how to use it? And you'd like log on and you're like, Kevin, you're muted again. I can't see your screen, Janice. And then, like, was that a cat that just walked past your keyboard? Like, that stuff was happening all the time. Nobody liked that. But you know what researchers would tell us now? Is that more people, the gospel went global in that moment. More people who would never step foot in a church building like this actually had Jesus step foot in their living room. Because we all had to figure out, how do you do COVID church? And what looked like the worst thing, and I don't think God wanted that. I don't necessarily even think that God planned that, but I know God used it. And some of you even are here today, or you're watching online because of that time when you felt hopeless and you found through an unexpected moment God had a strategy. Isn't that amazing? Do you think he could maybe do that in your situation? Paul says, that's the first place I find my joy. We don't wait till we understand God's strategy. We find joy because he has one. It's a grace-anchored gladness. Secondly, Paul says, we can find joy when critics attack us. He says this, it's true that some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry. Isn't that funny? There are some people out there that are preaching Jesus just because they actually want to try to make me look bad. Some of them out of goodwill. The latter do so out of love, knowing that I'm here for the defense of the gospel. The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition. They see Paul's pain and they go, ooh, I can build a platform for myself on this. I'll just give the same message that he was giving, but I'll do it better because he's in jail. Not sincerely, supposing they can stir up trouble for me while I am in chains. And then listen to this word. But what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached, and because of this, I rejoice. Let's be honest for a second. Some of the deepest wounds that you have, some of the deepest wounds that I have, are from people who claim to love Jesus. The words they've said, the unfair criticism they've made of you, the lies, or at least bad perspective that they've given, spoken out loud. Do you have a critic in your life? I'm just looking. Do you have a critic? Do you have somebody at work? You got it. You have somebody that's constantly like sending you those passive-aggressive emails or examples of like, we should do it this way. You should be this kind of leader. You should preach these kind of... Wow, that just got real personal. We've all got it. It doesn't matter what the situation is. You have them. Or you live with one that feels critical. Paul had people that were constantly attacking his character, and it didn't bother him. Why? It should, right? Criticism, especially unfair criticism, it hurts. Paul says, you know why it doesn't bother me? One, because my identity is not on trial. I am in this prison and I am loved, held, kept, secured, purposed, and redeemed by the God of the universe. Say whatever you want. But secondly, he saw something even better. He said, while you guys are trying to trash me and build up your own little following on Instagram or whatever it is that you're doing, while you're doing that, you are also making Jesus famous. And I don't care what your motive is. All I care about, he saw a purpose that was bigger. He wanted the gospel proclaimed. He wanted Christ magnified. And any way that it happened, he was fine with. That's how you find joy. When critics attack us. His response, who cares? Jesus gets lifted up. I win. Isn't it hard to imagine this right now? Some of you are like, this feels so foreign, so impossible. But let me remind you where he was sitting. When he wrote these words, we know now that he ended up getting out of this jail. I mean, later, after this, God was going to rescue him. But he didn't know it. All he knew was what the circumstances around him looked like. And he said, here's what I know. God is with me in it, and he's working for good. And as long as he gets glory, I don't care what happens to me. The secret to joy is learning to live like you're loved right now. Because you are. Because God is so proud of you. He is so enamored with you. He thought you so valuable that he died for you and adopted you. Tell that to the critic's voice, especially if it sounds like your voice. Anybody your own worst critic? Right? If that's the voice that's playing, remind it. Remind them that your value couldn't be less in question, no matter what the circumstances look like. You can actually have joy when people speak badly about you. Then finally, and this may be the toughest one, Paul says you can have joy when the future is uncertain. Now, how many of us live in the fog of uncertainty? Does anybody see clearly through the windshield of uncertainty? It's like, do you know where it's all going? Because I really want to talk this week. If that's you, if you're certain. We are uncertain all the time. We're uncertain if this treatment is going to work. We're uncertain if our kid is going to return to faith or return home. We're uncertain if this can be fixed. We're uncertain if this job is going to last long enough to be able to get me through retirement. We're uncertain if my body is ever going to heal. We are uncertain of everything. The illusion of control or predictability is one that we need psychologically to just keep walking every day, but it is an illusion. Paul says, you can even rejoice when the future's uncertain. Look at this, 19 and 20. I'll continue to rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and God's provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. So he says, here's what's going to happen. I don't know the future. But either I'm going to get miraculously rescued out of this situation, and God's going to get glory for that. Ooh, I eagerly expect and hope that in waiting for that, I will in no way be ashamed. I hope I'm worthy to wait for God to do what he's going to do. But will have sufficient courage so that now, as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether by life or by death. Paul's like, what are we worried about? It's funny, I was thinking this week on Instagram, I saw this meme, and it was for those of you that are chronic worriers. It said, 90% of the things I worry about never happen. See, worrying works. It has pushed off 90% of the stuff that could have happened. How many of you make it a habit? It's like your skill, your spiritual gift, you think is worrying. And you can worry stuff away, right? Paul is he's sitting in the jail, not sure what's going to happen, no certainty of the future, and he just goes, here's what I do know. Either God's going to rescue me and I'm going to get out of this and he's going to be glorified, or I'm going to die and go be with Jesus. And he literally says later, I'm not sure which one's better. Can you imagine having a joy so solid, a hope so rooted, that you'd go, if I die, I win. If I live, I win. He cannot lose. This is not toxic positivity. Paul actually is not living in denial of his situation. He's living in defiance. Yeah, I see what that looks like, but I'm not going to let that determine my worth, my hope, or my joy. Now, I want you to hear this too. We're about to wrap up. This is really, really important. These are Paul's processed thoughts. This is not Paul in the moment. Because some of you, I know you, because I am you, you're sitting here right now and you actually are like, I want that so bad, and you're starting to feel guilty that you're not there. You're thinking like, this is, see, I can't even do this. I can't even worry right. This is not Paul's early stage in the moment thoughts. Those sound different. Those sound like the Psalms. Have you ever read some of those prayers? That is just raw, real emotion that you and I should feel and we should live through and we should grieve. That's when David says something like this. And in one of the Psalms, he says, God, it is so clear that you don't care about me or you've forgotten that I think maybe, what, are you busy in the bathroom? No lie. Can you imagine saying that to God? David is just real. Are you still in there? That's what unprocessed thoughts look like. You don't get joy just because you say, I'll be joyful. This is a process. You learn this. Paul said another time, I despaired of death. He tells us, though, at the end of this book, we're going to get in a few weeks, I learned to be content in every situation. So please hear me. Do not allow yourself to feel guilty because you're not there. But do not allow yourself to succumb to the belief that you will always be here. Do you hear that? Grieve your losses and your circumstances. Grieve them, but don't ground yourself in them. Don't get stuck in them. Don't let that voice tell you that this is ultimate reality. It's not. God has a strategy. He is with you. He defends you. And whether you live or whether you die, you can't lose. There's a lady named Corrie Ten Boom, and I just found out after the first service, I mentioned her. Anybody know who Corrie Ten Boom is? You ever heard that name? Right? So she saved a whole bunch of people during the Holocaust. But here's what you may not know, and what I found out is Corrie Ten Boom spoke here. Were any of you here for that? That is crazy. She lived in Placentia. What in the world? This woman, she wanted to be married more than anything in her life. And she had a really, really, when she was a young lady, young adult, she had a relationship that she thought was the one, and it broke off, and it devastated her. And she was like, I cannot even imagine that this is the way life's going to turn out. She never got married. God never answered in that way. But here's what she says. She ends up during the Holocaust, because she doesn't have a family, she's not tied in ways that she could never have dreamed. She was able to rescue so many people. God had a different plan for her. And she says this at the end of her life, never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God. Say that again. Say that to yourself. Never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God. Where we find joy, how we're going to learn it, and this is just week one. We're going to work through the next few weeks a skill set to be able to cultivate this. But where we're starting today is this. Joy is found in the presence of God. It's found being in and recognizing the purpose of God. Psalm 16:11, I think this would be a great one for you to just meditate on this week. Take a screenshot, look it up, do it on your phone. Have this over and over and over again. The writer says, you make known to me the path of life. I don't know the future, but you make known to me. You show me the path towards life. And you will fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. That's where joy is found. When you see, you begin to recognize God in all your situations, especially the hard ones. This is where joy is grown. When you look at an uncertain future and you say, that's okay because I know the one who is already in the future and he's with me now. This is where joy is found. When the critics stop sounding so powerful because your identity is not on trial, Jesus already did that. I'm telling you, folks, when Paul wrote this letter, it's funny. This is the only church that Paul writes to that he doesn't like say something mean. Not mean, but, you know, corrective. He just praises them. And I think we could become this church. I think that's part of why it's here. We could be a church, a group of people, individually and collectively, that have so learned and cultivated joy that outside the world looks at us and goes, I gotta have some of that. And you know what? If you're not there today, lean on a brother and sister who is. If you're not there today, look for God in all those difficult places and find out, is he really present? Because if he is, the God of the universe can make something beautiful out of your trouble. Paul said, I can't lose. Whether I live or whether I die, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. Joy is not pretending it's all good. It's proclaiming that he is good even when it's not. And this table of communion that we're about to take together is the best, such a beautiful example of that truth. When Jesus goes to the cross, it looked like the plan had gone all wrong. Incomprehensible. Really? This is what you had planned? And in that moment, Jesus shows us that he is perfectly centered in his identity and who God is and who he is to him. And he walks forward into an uncertain future. And we all found freedom because of it.